Chapter 27, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 27, A Visit to Bulgase, a Greek refugee camp. Team F of the commission, under the championship of the Brazilian delegate, Mr. Antonio Mendes Biana, drove to Bulgase, 60 miles north of Belgrade, on April day, to investigate the assertion of the Greek government that Greek refugees were being trained there for guerrilla warfare, and I was allowed to go along. It was Mr. Mendes Viana's kind doings. Brazilians are really such gentlemen. Team F didn't expect that day to see Greek refugees in the act of being trained. The plans for their visit were too well known, but they did hope to question witnesses who might throw further light on the matter. Witnesses in Greece had testified before the commission that they had been given military instruction there, and the commission had received as evidence a military manual stressing mountain guerrilla fighting used in the Bulgase courses. Also, they had heard that the refugees were supplied with arms, ammunition, food, and medical care. We left Belgrade at 8:15 in the morning in about a dozen cars with an escort of motorcycle policemen. In fact, the car in which I rode with Mr. Alexis Kirou, the Greek liaison representative, and Mr. Ibsan Inglisi, the Syrian delegate, who for some reason was called Sam by everybody, had two motorcycle cars, fore and aft. The signal honor, Mr. Kirou felt sure, was because of him. The Yugoslavs had no intention of letting him out of their sight. Both gentlemen spoke English with delightful accents, and we had a fine time chatting on the way. Sam Inglisi is private secretary to the president of Syria, and in that capacity traveled with him to see the fabulous oil character, King Ibn Saud. The king became attached to Sam, which I can easily understand, and gave him as a parting gift an enormous and magnificent camel's hair robe embroidered in gold. Sam brought it with him when he came to Greece, and on the trip that he and the other members of the commission took into the mountains of Macedonia to interview the guerrilla leader, General Marcos, it served not only as a robe but as a tent. Four members of the team, including Mrs. Fothergill, the Britisher, Brian Johnston, the Australian, and Ace Miller and Sam, had to stay in one small room and sleep on the floor with just a bit of straw beneath them. Under these primitive conditions, no one bothered to take off his clothes at night except Sam. He went into his robe as if it were a small dressing room, took off his clothes, and put on his pajamas. He, perhaps, bathed too. He didn't mention it, but I wouldn't put it past him. The next morning, he would retire into the robe again and dress. It didn't sound too safe to me. It didn't sound too safe to me, and Mrs. Fothergill must have felt the same way, for Sam admitted she always turned her head the other way. We had no experience like that on the trip to Bulgase, but we all had other types. It was a terrifically exciting day from the hour we took off until exhausted and emotionally spent. We returned in full moonlight around midnight to Belgrade. Almost as soon as we crossed the Save River, that was the one, remember, I didn't know when I first looked down on Belgrade from the mountaintop and saw the sprawling white and sprawled white and disheveled in the triangle formed by this unknown river flowing into the Danube. I didn't know when I first looked down on Belgrade from the mountaintop and saw her sprawled white and disheveled in the triangle formed by this unknown river flowing into the Danube. we entered a historic section of Yugoslavia called Vojvodina, which up until 1918 was a part of Austria-Hungary. Here, Serbs casting homesick eyes toward Belgrade live side by side with Austrians, Hungarians, and Germans. It is a beautiful country of broad, fertile lands stretching as far as the eye can see, and of fairy storybook villages. Really, they were so quaint I could not believe the horny hand of man had built them, but instead the good witch who turned Cinderella into the beautiful princess and the four rats into prancing horses. They were only a street big, with no business section to mention, but just tiny plastered houses, each whitewashed in a different Easter egg shade, pale yellow, pink, blue, lettuce green, chartreuse and lavender, and decorated beneath the eaves and on the walls of the porches with painted garlands of roses, sheaves of wheat, fields of corn, ropes of wisteria. Can you imagine? There was one whitewashed in Wedgwood blue, with wide open yellow roses and dark green leaves trailing about it, painted, of course, and another baby pink with bright blue doors and windows, and another soft faded salmon with painted clumps of gray-green olive trees and green window trims and green doors. Every house in every village except one looked as if it had just had the tissue lifted from it. The lone exception was still being painted by an old woman with a long handle brush that reached the eaves. We thought at first that they had been newly done for us, for such amazing things were pulled off to impress the commission, but later we learned that they were freshened up every year for Easter. Thatched roofs hung over the colored walls like shaggy eyebrows, and over the roofs spread the blossoming limbs of pear trees, real, not painted. The entrances and porches, as with old Charleston and Savannah houses, were on the side away from the street and faced upon walled-in courts. There were many of these quaint villages, for here, as in Greece and Bulgaria and other European countries, all the peasants live in villages and towns instead of on their plots of land. I chose as my favorite Batajnica, Nica. It looks like a charming place to live, I said. For a few days only, Sam in Glitzy answered, and then the regime come on you. Up a long, easy hill, and from the crest, we saw a bright yellow church with two stately papa steeples, circled by eight identical baby steeples, and all silhouetted against the broad blue canvas of the Danube. Look, I shouted at Sam and Mr. Kiru, the Danube is blue, isn't it? Just as blue can be. Yes, here it looks blue, Mr. Kiru admitted, but what are you going to say about it at Belgrade, where it isn't blue? I just won't mention it. We followed along the Danube's gentle banks until we came to the ancient city of Novi Sad, where the long, crumbling walls of an Austrian fort crawl over a high bluff, and the cathedral has a multicolored, mosaic-looking roof. Here we stopped briefly for a breakfast lunch, and then traveled on through more picturesque farmlands and villages. The people stood in front of their painted houses to watch us go by, but they did not smile or wave. We waved. I have a weakness for waving at people. But they simply stared stodgily at us. They have no more spirit, Mr. Kiru commented. Around noon, we approached Bulcase. Gray-clad soldiers with the communist emblems on their caps lined both sides of the roadway for at least a mile outside the town. They stood at attention, their long, swaggering coats and their pants beautifully pressed, and their belts and boots shining as brightly as the surface of the Danube. Bulcase is a town of all-white buildings, nestling among green trees along wide roadways. For centuries, only Germans lived there, and it still beats the imprint of their passion for order and cleanliness. What happened to them, I don't know, to tell the truth. I don't want to know, but they are all gone now, every last one of them, and the Greek refugees have taken over. As we came into the town, we saw the first evidence of the Greek communist occupation. EAM, the initials of the communist organization in Greece, and the old familiar slogan, "Out with the British," were painted in white on white walls. Also, a new slogan, since the Truman Doctrine, "Out with the Americans." Greek and Yugoslav flags waved together over public buildings. We parked the car and walked along a sunny, empty street into a small building where the investigation was to be held. Inside, there was a fair-sized room with tables around the walls. A picture of President Roosevelt, oddly enough, hung over the door. Quickly, we filed in and took our seats. Mr. Mendez Viana rapped his gavel for the committee to come to order. But there was no order, for as he rapped, the street, which had been sunny and empty a minute before, was suddenly packed with 3,000 shrieking, roaring, bellowing men and women. They were wild, mad, and possessed like holy rollers, crying in unknown tongues and flinging their taut bodies into the air, like Kentucky mountaineers rocking to and fro and wailing before the spectacle of a rattlesnake-defying brother, like camp meeting, South Georgia Baptists jumping up and down and shouting in the throes of salvation. "Eam, Eam, 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 Eam," they yelled in rhythm over and over. "Eam, Eam, Eam." There was no let up, no rest, no lull. "Eam, Eam, Eam." There could be no meeting. No one in the room could possibly hear himself speak. With the Greek newspaper woman, I went out into the passageway that ran under the building from the courtyard into the street to see and hear better. The men were young, hard, weather-beaten, swarthy. They had fled to Yugoslavia, they claimed, to save their lives from the wrath of the Greek monarcho-fascist government. But the Greek government, as I have said, claimed differently. They were here solely to be trained in guerrilla warfare so that they could go back into the mountains of northern Greece and fight more effectively. "Eam, Eam, Eam," they cried. My head went around with it. No cheerleaders at a football game ever achieved such thudding, throbbing, pounding, hammering, drumming rhythm. Somewhere in the vortex, a woman with a keening voice set the time. Suddenly, without dropping a beat, they changed to, "Out with the Americans! Out with the Americans!" They shouted in Greek, of course, but the newspaper woman translated for me. Then, "Out with the British!" And on and on, on and on. Then, "Justice to our nations," meaning Greece, of course, and "Government with Eam! Government with Eam!" Women with small babies in their arms began to join the mob. They marched in a single line along the front edge of the mass and took their stand there where the members of the commission, looking out of the windows at the meeting room, could not fail to see them. Next came small children, it was perfectly planned, who stood in front of the women holding babies. There were perhaps 20 or 30 women and children, a small number for 3,000 men with only peaceful pursuits on their minds, but more than sufficient for warriors. The mothers and children screamed with the young men and girls. Back in the committee room, when I returned, Mr. Mendez Viana was trying to get order. He is a big, heavy-set man with a big, heavy-set face, and people usually move when he speaks to them. But today he was helpless. Couldn't one of the Yugoslav liaison officers stop the yelling so the meeting could get underway? He was pleading. Couldn't one of the Greek witnesses stop them? Couldn't anybody stop them? Finally, Yugoslavia's first witness, the Greek mayor of Bulkes, stepped to a window and held up his hand for quiet. He was a handsome man, slim, dark, and curly-haired, with classical features. At first, he did not get quiet. The drumming continued. "We want independence! We want independence!" Still, he held up his hand. Slowly, the din diminished. "Now stop," he cried firmly. "Stop, and don't shout any more, for I am going to speak in your behalf." There was silence, dead silence, but no one in the mob went away. With the sun beating down steadily upon their uncovered heads, they stood jammed in the middle of the wide road, while out of sight, out of their sight, the mayor read for 1 hour with a denunciation of the monarcho-fascist Greek government. The refugees in Bulcaise, he said, were the real Greek patriots who had fought the Nazis and supported the Allies. And as a reward, they were prosecuted by the Greek monarcho-fascists kept in power by British arms. "They are our persecutors," he shouted angrily, "and obliged us to flee away to save our lives." From February 1945, thousands of people flew into neighboring countries, and particularly to Yugoslavia. Laborers dressed in their work clothes, agriculturalists who abandoned their homes and their businesses, pregnant women, women carrying their babies in their arms, old men and little children. These people were terrified fugitives. The flow of fugitives continued interminably to several Yugoslavian camps, he said, but finally in June 1945 they were gathered together at Bulcaise. "From the first day of our establishment we worked to live," he declared, "and we had only one wish, to see our country free from the tyranny of the foreigners and of the neo-fascists, so that we shall be able to return to our homes." Babies cried and squirmed in their mother's arms outside the window, but still the mayor talked on. Children stood first on one foot and then on another, but they stood. The mass of men, with a sprinkling of women, scarcely moved at all. They waited stolidly. The mayor said with fiery defiance that the refugees in Bulcaise had no time to study mountain warfare and to form guerrilla bands. That was simply a concoction of the imagination of the Greek monarcho-fascist government. "Gentlemen, only a look at our community will give you the picture of our lives and our occupation," he stated. "Efforts for the security of our lives is our daily occupation. 23 stamas of grounds are cultivated and are needing thousands and thousands of daily workers. Hundreds of animals need care, and our laboratories need all of our time. Gentlemen, I believe that the fact of 8 hours of work per day for all the people except people who are ill, children and babies, will be able to give reply to the lies of Mr. Tsaldaris," the Greek foreign minister. Outside the window, the sun disappeared and the sky turned quickly black as if a gargantuan press were rolling ink across it, and a high wind began to blow. The people in the roadway stirred. A terrible storm seemed imminent. What should they do? Undecided, they milled for a few minutes in the road, and then, once more, their howls rose and fell. "Eam, eam, eam." The mayor's voice faded. Only the rush of the storm and the shouts of the people filled the committee room. And darkness, almost night darkness. The faces of the committee loomed faintly rubber-white like balloons around a child's birthday table before the candles on the cake are lit. Mr. Mendez Viana called for lights. "Will someone kindly find the switch and turn on the lights?" he begged. But there was no switch. We continued to sit in darkness, washed by waves of shouting. The women with babies moved from the front of the line, but no one else stirred, not even the children. The limbs of the trees writhed, and the wind wailed, and the mass howled. Two men came into the room with kerosene lamps and put them on the tables. They dropped yellow pools close about their bases. The faces of the delegates looked pale and tired. It was now 3 o'clock. And they had been sitting since 12 with no refreshments except a light brunch they had eaten around 10 o'clock at Novi Sad. One or two far-sighted members surreptitiously passed caramel bars and Nabisco wafers beneath the table to special friends. Mammoth drops of rain fell, at first slowly and then faster and faster. like whiplashes, they beat upon the people in the roadway until they ducked their heads beneath their arms and fled. The committee resumed its investigation. Then when the mayor had finished his written statement and answered the questions the delegates put to him, it was time for Mr. Kiru to present his witnesses for the Greek government. He called for tea cum baras. There was a tense minute of expectancy. And then the Yugoslav liaison officer announced, "There is no man in this camp by the name of T. Kumbaras." "I'm not at all surprised," answered Mr. Kiru with a sly grin on his face. "I expected by now he would be back in Greece fighting with the guerrillas in the Pindus Mountains." The Yugoslav liaison officer howled that it was disgusting, underhanded, outrageous, and misleading for Mr. Kiru to insinuate that T. Kumbaras had been at Bulkis and had gone back to Greece. The mayor also said there had never been a man by that name at Bulkis. Never. "Do you know the names of all the refugees at Bulkis?" Mr. Mendez Viana put in. "Certainly. And no one by that name has ever been here?" "Not one." At which dramatic point, Mr. Kiru produced a Yugoslav newspaper dated November 7, 1946, giving the name of T. Kumbaras as one of the members of a labor brigade from Bulkis who had been awarded a decoration for exceptional work on the youth railroad. The paper was a bombshell to the Yugoslav liaison officers and the Russian delegate. They must see it with their own eyes. Excitedly, they passed it from one to the other, scanning the offending column. Convinced at last that T. Kumbaras' name was there, the Yugoslav delegate came up with an explanation. Perhaps T. Kumbaras was in some other refugee camp. One thing certain, he was not at Bulkis and never had been. The committee tried to move on to another witness, since Kumbaras was not available. Who else would Mr. Kiru like to call? Mr. Kiru would not like to call anybody. He felt he had proven his point that Greek refugees came to Bulkis, were trained, and then were sent back to Greece, and he was ready to rest his case. But the Greek government had not used the time allotted to it. Surely there was some other witness. While this argument was raging, Sam Inglesi, who had been strolling about on the outside of the committee room, appeared at the door and announced that he had found T. Kumbaras. The committee was in an uproar. How could the Syrian delegate have found Kumbaras if Kumbaras had never been in Bulkis? Sam didn't know the answer to this, but he had found a young man who said he was T. Kumbaras. Mr. Mendez Viana ordered Sam to produce him. Sam produced him. He was a very youthful, bewildered-looking fellow with a wing of black hair falling over his forehead. "Are you T. Kumbaras?" asked Mr. Mendez Viana. "Yes," answered the Greek. Mr. Mendez Viana looked at the Yugoslav liaison representative, at the Greek mayor, at the Russian delegate. The Yugoslav representative quickly suggested that T. Kumbaras was an alias, and as the man was registered in Bulkis by his real name, the authorities had not known him by this alias. Mr. Mendez Viana was skeptical. Mr. Kiru was skeptical. Did the Yugoslav representative mean to suggest that the Yugoslav government would use an alias when it decorated a man for exceptional service? The Yugoslav representative did mean that. Were the other names in the articles aliases too? Perhaps. And if the Yugoslav government singled out a Greek refugee from Bulkis to honor him in this fashion, would not the Yugoslav representative and the Bulkis mayor know him by this alias? Not necessarily. Then how did the Yugoslav representative know this was T. Kumbaras? In fact, how did anybody know it was Kumbaras? Did Kumbaras himself know he was Kumbaras? It couldn't have been more confusing. The delegates believed a hoax had been pulled on them, and they were in no mood to accept anybody's word on anything. As Mr. Mendez Viana pointed out, it was a Pandora box. For an hour they argued, Was Kumbaras Kumbaras, or was Kumbaras somebody the Yugoslav representative and the Greek mayor had hurriedly planted for Mr. Iglesi to find? Finally, harassed, outraged, Mr. Mendes Viana cried out, "Will the members of the committee please come to the assistance of their chairman in this most difficult hour?" It was too much to hear a big-bodied, big-voiced, big-minded Mr. Mendes Viana calling for help broke the tension. The delegates rocked with laughter, but it was no laughing matter with the chairman. He lashed out at those same nations which had turned this investigation into a comedy, and then snapped, I hear a motion to adjourn?" He did. It had stopped raining by the time we got into the road, but the mud was ankle-deep. Picking our way, we slid about the town, visiting the theater and the kindergarten, and as we walked, the men and girls who had put on the demonstration at noon began to gather again and line the sides of the road. They looked tough as elephant's hide to me. The men's eyes were glassy bright and staring, and their faces were black with stubby beards. As they swelled rapidly in number, the Yugoslav soldiers, or perhaps they were police, came running through the mud to stand in front of them and hold them back from the road. Our tour of inspection was over. We climbed into the cars for the return trip to Belgrade. The hour was dusk. The wide, muddy road was full of shadows. Suddenly, the Greek refugees began to shout, to shake their fists, to surge forward. The soldiers reached out and formed a human rope to hold them back. "The British must go," they shrieked. "The Americans must go." They stretched their mouths and bawled with all the force of their lungs. Their faces contorted in grimaces, and their eyes rolled in their heads. We started forward, but got no distance. Several cars ahead of us were stuck in the mud. The yelling Greeks lunged towards us. The car I was in was the last in the line. If they tore anybody to pieces, it would be us, and they surely looked as if they intended tearing somebody. I cowered against the back seat between my two companions. "The British must go, the British must go, the British must go." They lunged nearer and nearer. They strained mightily at the arms of the soldiers. Suppose an arm gave way. Our car jerked forward. I did not sigh. I did not even breathe. The shouting boomed louder to follow us in a last violent burst. The mayor, standing at the end of the refugees' line where the road turned out of the town, was smiling his approval as we passed. He and the Greek communists had put on a superb, spontaneous demonstration. End of chapter 27.